Everybody tonight? You guys ready for the cold weather to come in on us finally? No?
What's this alleged cold weather?
That's what they're saying. They're saying it's going to get cold. But I don't know. Cold, as my son from Chicago would say. Well, if you got a Bible with you or a way of following along, if you want to head over to Isaiah chapter 53, please. Isaiah, remember, is the book written by or in the spirit of, at least, the prophet Isaiah, who was a prophet to the southern kingdom of Israel. The first part of the book that we read, Isaiah was talking to the king and encouraging him to trust God while the Assyrian invasion was taking place. Second half of the book, which is what we're in now, is dealing with the Babylonian captivity, whether this is the original Isaiah forecasting into the future what was going to take place, or whether this is another writer in the spirit of Isaiah who is speaking comfort to Israel. The nature of this last section of the book is about comforting Israel, comforting them during their time of trouble and their heartache and their difficulties that they've been facing in exile in Babylon. In chapter 52, Isaiah again was describing what redemption from exile was going to look like. And we've talked about this before, but we want to remember that this is the key theme of the Bible all the way through, is this idea of redemption, of the release from slavery, the release from exile. This motif gets repeated over and over and over again, even through the Gospels, on into the New Testament epistles. This is what this is about. And for him, in this context, he was describing to him what release from exile was going to look like. How even though they sold themselves into slavery, he said, for nothing, they were going to be redeemed for nothing. In other words, they were going to get redeemed, and it wasn't going to cost them anything, that God was going to take care of that. So when we left off, it was right in the middle of another, what we've described as servant songs, where Isaiah begins to prophetically describe someone who's coming, someone who's going to come on the scene in Israel's history, who's going to do something remarkable in advancing this purpose of redemption in the lives of the Israelites and as well as the whole world as it gets forecast that way. So he's poetically describing this someone. He's a hero in his description, but we understand him to be describing Messiah. And this is what the Israelites at that time were waiting for. And of course, those who haven't received Christ are still waiting for Messiah to show up. But this is what they were anticipating. This someone, this heroic king-like figure who's going to come on the scene and bring the kingdom of God with him. The thing is, as we started this servant song in the last chapter, it began last chapter near the last few verses, this description is different from anything anyone was expecting. He's not at all fulfilling what everybody would have assumed. While we would, expect God to break into history with a great display of cataclysmic power, that's what we would assume that God would move in on human history with, what Isaiah described in last chapter was somebody who's coming in, experiencing humiliation and apparent defeat, being abused. He was described as being mutilated beyond recognition. What an odd thing. What a strange concept. This idea of a suffering servant was something that Israel just did not anticipate well. They didn't see that one coming very well. Even though Isaiah describes him here in such astonishing detail long before he ever came on the scene, Isaiah was saying these things at least 400 years before he came on the scene, possibly 600 years before Jesus was there. Tonight, we're going to come to one of the most famous sections of all of this fourth servant song. It's what most believe is the actual linchpin of New Testament theology. It's been referred to as the Holy of Holies of Old Testament literature because of the way that it describes the experiences that Messiah go through and how accurately they display what it is Jesus experienced. Most of the 80-some references that the New Testament has of Isaiah are actually out of this chapter right here. This is the most quoted chapter in the book of Isaiah, while Isaiah is the most quoted book in the New Testament from the Old Testament. So this is the moment when Israel is suffering in exile, enduring these kinds of hardships. God suddenly pulls back the curtain and he gives one of the clearest glimpses of his amazing plan to redeem not only Israel, but all of mankind. He reveals the scope of what it really means to return from exile, to leave exile and come back home. And what's revealed here, what it is that Isaiah either sees or is enunciating is, well, Isaiah himself seems to have difficulty with it. He seems dismayed by what it is that he's actually reporting to his fellow Israelites, because it's different from anything anyone ever expected. It's this unthinkable way in which God goes about to redeem humanity without money. That was his promise. I'm going to redeem you without money, at no cost to you, but doesn't mean without a cost. And here we see how the greatest cost falls on him. So if you're there, we're going to start in Isaiah 53, start with verse 1. He says, he says it. I promise that he says it. You'll have to advance this for me. It's not working again. There we go. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. Isaiah opens this section of his song with a sort of a startled cry at what it is that he's been shown here. In the message, this chapter starts with, who believes what we've heard and seen? Who would have thought God's saving power would look like this? Isaiah is astonished by what it is that he's actually even revealing as a prophet, because the Lord, he says, has revealed his arm. Now, to reveal his arm is an expression. It's an expression to try to describe somebody revealing his strength or his power. It's kind of like we would say, rolled up his sleeve to get busy here. So God is revealing his power. He's rolling up his sleeve. He's revealing his arm. And we would think that God's arm would be really powerful looking, you know, like a ultimate fighter or a weightlifter or something with a cool, you know, sword, flaming sword tattoo on it or something like that. But we're surprised because suddenly God rolls back his sleeve and his arm is like really ordinary. I mean, it's like, just sort of average and ordinary. And it prompts Isaiah to say, you're not going to believe this, but this very ordinary, very non-muscly kind of arm, it proves to be the most powerful arm of all, more powerful than any other arm, more powerful than death itself. By starting this off by saying, this is going to be hard to believe, Isaiah is actually anticipating that many people are going to be rejecting Messiah for this very reason alone, because this just doesn't fit. This just doesn't make any sense whatsoever. He believes, obviously, that Messiah is going to have trouble convincing people that he is who he says he is, just because he doesn't fit the expectations well. And you know what? That's something that we've got to keep in mind about Jesus to this day. He doesn't always fit our expectations that way. He rarely actually conforms to our expectations. The moment we think we've got him figured out is the moment we suddenly realize, oh, wait, I'm like miles off the mark on this whole thing. How many times have you gone through figuring, okay, I know exactly what it is God's going to be doing here in my life in this situation, and suddenly finding that we don't know really anything about what it is that he's doing. We keep trying to put God in a box, and he keeps busting up our boxes. But that certainly doesn't stop us from building boxes. We just keep building them, and he keeps smashing them to bits, and we keep building. It seems to be our little thing that we do with God. And verse 2 even elaborates on this, because where we were expecting a mighty oak tree or a giant redwood of power and majesty, Messiah shows up like a little shoot, he says, like a sprig that pops up in the deserts. Everything about what he's describing in that right there, a shoot in the desert, a sprig, it carries the connotation of weakness and vulnerability. That's an alarming thing to be saying when you're saying this is how the arm of the Lord gets revealed. We would expect that Messiah, when he shows up, not only is going to have power and stuff, but he's also going to be attractive in some way. You know, we're going to be drawn to him because he's going to show up in some sort of dazzling array of beauty that just captures our attention and captivates our gaze. We expect him to I don't know, you know, look like a young Sean Connery or a Jeremy Renner. And instead he shows up looking like Woody Allen or Michael Cera, Sarah, and everybody's confused. They're looking at it going, him? This guy? This is the Messiah? And when we consider Jesus in light of this revelation of what it is that Isaiah is saying here, the pieces begin to fall into place as we think about him. Because we remember that he came into this world. When he came in as a baby, not as a king. He was born in a cow barn, not in a palace somewhere. He actually shows up in some beat up little Roman colony out in the middle of nowhere, kind of like Two Egg, Florida or something, instead of showing up in Rome, the seat of power, or at least in Jerusalem, the holy city. He was homeless in his lifetime. He was surrounded by the uneducated and the marginalized of society. He talked about peace and forgiveness while the Israelites were waiting for a general who was going to lead him into battle. And then he was going to die this what is ultimately the most humiliating death that anybody could die in that time, in that place in the world. This was the arm of the Lord revealed. This was God's power made manifest in the earth. And this is why Isaiah's shaking his head saying, you're not going to believe this. What it is that's happening here. And we sort of realize then from Isaiah's introduction of this, that faith, when we talk about faith, we talk about believing God. You know, he says, who's believed this report? Who's believed all this stuff? That's the underlying premise of this concept of believing God, of having faith. I realize from this that believing is not about getting God to conform to our plans and to our wishes, but rather it's about our willingness to be amazed at what it is that he's doing and go along with it without making other demands. I know I spent a lot of time in my own life trying to get God to conform to my demands. I would walk around and claim those propositional promises and tell God what it is that he needed to do. And, you know, that left me pretty much beat up and ruined for the most part. How much better it is to recognize, okay, God's running wild in the earth, so I'm just going to let him run loose and I'm just going to follow him on what his plan seems to be. We just got to, you know, try to stop building those boxes. No matter how well we think we've built them, he's not going to stay in them. So he goes on here, verse 3. He says, can you advance for me? Thank you. He says, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Now, the word here, the English word despise, when we say despise, that carries with it a connotation of some intense emotions, you know, like, oh, I despise spreadsheets, or I despise, it's just me. I despise spreadsheets because they never make any sense to me. Because, I mean, a spreadsheet, you'd think that you'd, you know, spread it out. You should read, but there's always columns that go down, and it never makes any sense. Believe it or not, we're not talking about spreadsheets, but the idea is, despised carries with that connotation of emotion, but that's really not resonant in the word that is used here in the Hebrew. He's not saying despised in that sense, but it actually means to be counted as worthless, as something that is unworthy of any attention whatsoever. So in reality, what he's saying here is that that Messiah was dismissed. Even though Jesus did suffer scorn, he did experience that sort of intense emotion of scorn leveled against him. What Isaiah is describing here is the idea that he was just going to be dismissed, thrown out like you'd throw out a Burger King wrapper or something like that. They'd reject him because they saw no value in him. They didn't see anything about him that seemed to indicate that he was going to be valuable to Israel, their place in the covenant, or their place even in history. They turned away from him because he looked like someone with his own problems, is what Isaiah is saying here. You know, he's a man of sorrows and grief. In other words, he's a guy who seems to be surrounded by all kinds of troubles and difficulties. Basically, you could sum that up saying that, you know, he looked like a loser. You know, there was a lot of things going wrong for this guy in his experiences here. And, you know, it's very rare that when we're in trouble or we're looking for help, we're going to find somebody who's got a lot of troubles of his own and see if he can help us. We don't do that. You kind of marginalize somebody like that. We don't look for help from someone who's experiencing their own trouble. That's why the Jewish people of that day rejected Jesus. They didn't see him as the one coming to fulfill their expectations of Messiah. He was too swamped by troubles that were surrounding him. And that's why Jesus is rejected by Jewish people to this day, because of the troubles that he experienced because of his death on the cross. Because they say, well, that's impossible. He didn't seem to be able to save himself from that. How in the world is he going to save the world? So the setup here is fantastic. What it is that Isaiah is describing here, how is this ugly, scrawny loser supposed to reveal the power of God? How in the world is that going to be the means by which God is going to show off his dazzling display of ability to rescue not only his covenant people, but all of humanity? Well, Isaiah goes on to explain that all is not as it seems on the surface as he gets to verse 4. In verse 4, he says, "Surely he's borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we're healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all." All right, in chapter 52, as we pointed out, God made the promise, "I'm going to redeem you without money." And here is how he's explaining that he's going to do it. Something that comes into focus in this stanza that actually reveals the very heart of New Testament theology, and that is the idea of a substitutionary death. The servant's appearance and vulnerability, this appearance of weakness, this surrounding trouble and sorrow, all of this was for the benefit of humanity. All of this was not his own issues, but something that he was actually carrying for us. It was the consequence for our sin that he was going to bear, not for his own sins, which, by the way, clearly marks him as distinct from any other prophet or any other human being on the planet, because he's someone without his own sin. Who would we attribute that to? Who could that be? Some who look at this and say, well, this isn't talking about a Messiah. This is talking about Israel. But that can't be accurate, because Israel had plenty of sins. They suffered because of their own sin. But this one, this someone here, is someone without his own sin who actually bears the sins of others, who is going to stand in the place of sinful humanity to receive the consequence of that sin in himself and on himself. Now, theologically, this is referred to as the doctrine of substitutionary atonement, which among all the various views of atonement still makes the most sense to me. I'm not necessarily saying penal substitutionary atonement, but substitutionary atonement is definitively described here in this chapter, and it seems to me to fit. If you were to go back to the ancient views of theories of atonement and talk about the ransom theory, it jibes with that, or even the Christus Victor theory. This is only for people who care about this. It's kind of like spreadsheets. We don't even have to think about it, but either way, this is on a theological level. This is talking about the idea of Christ, taking punishment or taking the consequence, we should word it, of sin onto himself, in our place as a substitute. Now, to the onlookers, it appeared that the servant was suffering the consequences of his own bad behavior. Yeah, this guy's getting beat up. This guy's going through all this stuff. Serves him right. Look at all the crazy claims that he made. You know, God was smiting him for his sins. And that's what the Jewish people of that day believed. They believe that to this day. He made himself equal with God. He made all these, claims that he didn't have to obey the Sabbath on different things. You know, all this stuff. That's reason enough. God's smiting him. God's taking him out because of his sin. But the reality was that this someone, this Messiah, was willingly suffering undeserved punishment in the place of sinful humanity. And that's the concept. And that is actually an underlying concept that carries with it the implications of what sacrificial love is all about. The willingness to lay down one's own rights and suffer even undeservedly on behalf of another in order to promote them and help them. It's pretty profound. Now, this would happen, as Isaiah is describing it here, in a violent and excruciating death. That's the context that he's putting up here. He's described as being wounded. Literally, that means to be pierced through fatally, which is an interesting choice of words when we consider how it is that Jesus did die, considering the means of crucifixion and also the spear that pierced him while he was on the cross. He said he would be crushed. Literally in the Hebrew, that means just broken to pieces, beat up. You could say beat up, beat to pieces. He would receive stripes, and that can mean either wounds inflicted by a cane, you know, how if you beat somebody with a cane, it would leave a striped bruise across them, or with a whip, it would leave, you know, some sort of a wound that would carry a striped laceration. Or it can mean a deep purple bruise. That can be one of the concepts behind it. A really deep, you know, you've gotten those before where they're, you know, they're just really gnarly and deep and painful. And so this is the context in which he puts this. Either way, no matter what, however we're going to look at the specifics of this, what Isaiah is doing is he's employing the strongest words that the Hebrew language had to offer to describe violent treatment of another person. And as we look from the New Testament backwards to what it is that Isaiah is saying here, we can see how appropriate these words were when they were applied to Jesus, the things that he endured and experienced in his death on the cross. This was the consequence of our iniquity, the iniquity, he says, of us all. That means my sins and everything that I did wrong. That means yours and everything you did wrong. That means all of those choices that we made that were in violation of God's will. This is the stuff that Jesus bore that consequence for. And that's a pretty heavy thought, but it's a wonderful thought at the same time, because the iniquity of us all carries with it that connotation that this is done. This is past, present, and future. All sin that ever was committed, that we would ever commit somewhere out there, because we're not yet in that place where we're perfected. All of that was paid for by that death that he died on that cross. We see the scope of this suddenly. We see the magnitude, how serious sin is. When we look at the cross and we consider what it is that Jesus endured there, we also get a glimpse of the magnitude, the heaviness of sin. This isn't just a cute little mistake or some intriguing little aberration that we got involved in. This is crushing, bruising, wounding, and its final result is death. That's what the cross reveals to us. You know, the cross reveals so many things. It reveals that. It reveals the nature of sin and what its consequence is. But it also reveals, beyond that catastrophic consequence, it reveals this incredible love that Messiah would actually endure that, not for himself, but for us, for our sake. Because we screwed up, he took that punishment to himself. Now, the question that arises and has arisen within different doctrinal camps, when he says, by his stripes we were healed, the question that comes up, well, is he talking about spiritual healing or is he talking about physical healing? Is this talking about our spirits, our souls being healed from sin? Or is this talking about our physical bodies getting healed in some supernatural way? I would say yes. In the ultimate sense, I believe that's what he's talking about. I believe that this is physical and spiritual healing that's intended in this, because it's still pointing towards the restoration of all things, which of course is going to be including both our spirit and our flesh. Some, and I used to be one of them, see verse 5 as a propositional promise that's going to guarantee us healing in every case. Well, you know, healing is attached to and a part of the atonement. And so therefore I'm going to claim healing because it's Jesus died for it and I get it automatically. I don't read it that way anymore because I put this in the context of what it is, a poem. This is a song written. This wasn't this was not like an insurance form with listing off my benefits or something like that. This is a poem. This is a song that was written. And what he's doing is he's providing for us a series of contrasts here of what's happening here. Just, you know, like we literally aren't sheep going astray, he's using the same kind of metaphor. He suffers and we get healed. He is rejected and we're accepted. In other words, we're receiving the opposite of what it is that he's taking on to himself. It's a passionate declaration of a substitute. We receive basically the opposite of what it is we deserve because he's taken that to himself. You know, that's one of those things. Everybody's just got to pray about that and decide what it is that this passage is saying and work with it. But that's how I read it. And you, of course, have to see how God would have you read it. Verse 7, he says, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that's led to slaughter, like a sheep that's before its shearers is silent. So he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off from the land of the living, stricken for the transgressions of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Now here, God's power gets revealed through, and this is really something, you just got to think about this for a moment. God's power gets revealed through submissiveness and through innocence and through unjust suffering. You just have to let that soak in for a minute. This is how God chose to reveal his power in the most awesome demonstration of power the world has yet known. That is not the normal way that we understand power. Not normally. He gets compared here to a lamb carrying that sacrifice motif on through here, down to its logical destination as the sacrificial lamb that was substitutionary in the Old Testament economy. The suffering servant makes this ultimate sacrifice. He lays himself down for others. And it's clear that the suffering servant is suffering undeservedly, and yet he does so without complaint or ever defending himself. And again, when people try to say, well, no, this isn't talking about a Messiah, this is talking about Israel. Well, again, here, this is not an accurate picture then of Israel's history, because they complained a lot. They defended themselves on a regular basis. They defend themselves to this day. That can't be a picture of that. This picture of meekness. And meekness, remember, doesn't imply weakness, but meekness means power that is under restraint, power that is held in check and withheld. This picture here of this kind of meekness is actually unique in all of Scripture, especially when it's applied to something like this. You go back through the Psalms, and we talked about that a couple Sundays ago as Cole was teaching about the place of lament, and you read the Psalms of lament. The normal response is to cry out for vengeance. The normal response is to defend oneself and to proclaim, look, this is my innocence, and here I'll show you my innocence. When Job was suffering undeservedly, he understood that he was, but his whole time was spent trying to defend himself to his free friends who came to try to explain, well, the reason this is happening is because you're a jerk. And he's saying, no, I'm not a jerk, really, honest. And you know, he just kept on through 38 chapters practically trying to explain, I'm okay, I'm not as bad as you guys are making me seem to be. I don't know why this is happening to me. So this is actually quite unique, this picture here of this servant who's undergoing this kind of suffering, this kind of undeserved suffering, who doesn't ever offer to defend himself, doesn't ever try to explain anything. And we only see that fulfilled in Christ's experiences in the New Testament, something that happens between 400 to 600 years after this was written. Because we know when Jesus was brought before the Sanhedrin during that illegal midnight trial, that he never defended himself. All these people line up to give false testimony about him. Yeah, I saw Jesus doing this. And Jesus never once says, I don't know what he's talking about, dude, man. That guy's crazy. Nope. He stays quiet, stays silent the entire time. When Pilate interrogated him later on, he didn't defend himself. And Pilate was getting frustrated with him. He said, don't you understand? I got the power to destroy you, man. He says, you don't have any power. That's all been given to you. You're not Lord like you think you are. And when he was brought before Herod, even more poignantly, the one who was supposed to be the king over Israel, Jesus never said a word, just stood there silently while he was being interrogated and abused. Yet Isaiah says this was all part of the plan, that all of this undeserved suffering was the means by which God was going to redeem his people. Who would have guessed, is what Isaiah said. Who understood that him going through all of this, by being cut off from the land of the living, by actually going down to the place of death, that this was the means by which God was going to rescue everybody. When Isaiah says, my people, he no doubt has covenant Israel in mind. But the fuller New Testament revelation of all of this helps us see that my people can actually evolve. Even though Isaiah, I'm sure, meant Israel, We can see now that that would evolve in our understanding to include all of humanity. All of humanity, my people, my fellow human beings. God did this to rescue us all. Now the final insult that gets heaped on this suffering servant is his burial here. His burial among the wicked. buried among everybody else who got exactly what they deserved, who suffered the consequence of their own bad behavior. But also burial, he says, among the rich, which is an interesting thing that Isaiah would bring that up. He buried among the rich, carried with it the connotation that cast an element of doubt on this servant's motives, the righteousness of his motives, the fact that he's associated with the rich. See, the rich, all through, at least within the realm of the prophets, when the prophets of Old Testament Israel are describing the rich, they're always talking about the oppressors, those who oppress people. So for him to be buried with the rich puts an immediate element of suspicion onto it. Well, why is he with these rich people? So, you know, you never know what this guy, he's probably all about money, he was whatever. What's weird, though, is that it's an odd juxtaposition here. We don't find that anywhere else in the Old Testament. Isaiah is indicating that the wicked and the rich are somehow going to be involved in the servant's burial and his grave. But why and how? And I can imagine a lot of people that were reading this, that were contemporary to Isaiah, were scratching their heads going, I don't know what he's talking about here. You know, there's a huge question mark lingering there. I don't know, you know, the wicked and the rich, what could it possibly mean? It wasn't until the full turn of events that took place in Jesus's experience actually made sense of anything that was said here. You think about that, the tumblers of a lock falling into place, and suddenly a door you never realized was there opens up. We have to keep those kinds of things in mind when it comes to reading and understanding the New Testament as well, because we're in a transitory dispensation. We're waiting for something else to come. And if we start trying to read some of these things that are forecasting an age that has yet to dawn and dogmatically make determinations about what it is that's being described or how that's going to work, we can find ourselves getting into trouble there. This wouldn't have made any sense whatsoever until what Jesus experienced actually transpired. So there's going to be things that take place that aren't going to make sense. You know, things that we read about in this word that are just not going to make sense until those days unfold. Which that's, you know, and we got to be okay with that. We got to be okay with mystery. Once we try to eliminate the element of mystery out of the scriptures, then, like I said, we've just got an insurance policy that we're reading benefit listings off of. That's not what this is. This is God's mysterious plan being revealed, unfolding in the world. We got to be okay with the idea that there's things in here that we just go, I don't know. You know me, when I get to those spots in here, I'm just like, whoa, that guy's brilliant. But it wasn't, you know, it wasn't until Jesus actually died, and then they could see how, you know, the wicked rulers conspired to destroy him and have him buried and put away, how a rich man, Joseph of Arimathea, stepped in at the last moment to claim the body and have him buried in his family tomb among the richer tombs that would have been there outside of Israel, or outside of Jerusalem, rather. The servant didn't defend himself through all of this, but also we know, as Isaiah is describing it here, he wasn't guilty of anything that was worthy of death. His lack of violence or deceit meant that he was sinless and he was true all the way to his death. Never did he turn from that course. It never changed. And again, this is a profound contrast, because when I think about all the energy that I've spent in my life trying to defend myself, or worse than that, all of the energy I've spent trying to defend Jesus to people who, you know, oppose him or whatever, to try to defend Jesus' reputation, you know, how distinctly different that is from Messiah's own actions and agenda. He didn't waste any time trying to argue his points. You notice that as you read through the Gospels. Jesus was not out with a bullhorn and cardboard signs trying to argue with people in that sort of an atmosphere or an attitude. He just lived it. He just lived out the reality that there's a new world coming and there's something better than this brokenness that we understand in this world right now. He just lived it, and he let the Father vindicate him when the time was right. And I think there may be a lesson in there for us. All right, he goes on, verse 10. He says, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He is put into grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. Now, in this last stanza, amidst all this undeserved suffering, we suddenly get a glimpse that actually startles us just a little bit further, that this all is apparently God's plan. Jesus wasn't a victim who fell afoul of people who were plotting against him. This was all the will of Yahweh to crush him. Now, that statement right there has an inherent conundrum attached to it. Would the loving, faithful Creator God intentionally visit an innocent person with suffering and pain? Would he really do something like that? As we look at the revelation as a whole, the only thing that we can come away with is that when the stakes are this high, apparently so. And this would be unique in any other experience. If this was the means by which humanity was going to be rescued, then God was willing to do it. John 3:16 says, because God so loved the world that he gave up his only unique son, obviously gave up to death, so that whoever would believe on him would become one of these righteous ones that Isaiah is describing here. Honestly, though, when I look at this, this is less a perplexing revelation about God and more an amazing picture about what God thinks of us. You think about that. At no other point in any time do we ever see any sort of willingness on God's part to visit destruction on somebody who is innocent of anything else, except in this one case, the stakes being this high, for God so loved not the world in the sense of the dirt and the trees, although I know he loves that too, but because of his humanity, this unique, this precious human race that he created in his own image. This should make us stumble back, to stagger just a little bit and be in awe of that. This is how worthwhile God sees you. God sees me. It's real easy in this broken world, in this place where, you know, our armpits get smelly and we say stupid things and all kinds of craziness happens all around us, that we could look at ourselves and see ourselves as less than valuable. We could get ourselves into situations or relationships where we suddenly feel we're not affirmed and we start to think, I'm not worth anything. I'm doing everything wrong. I'm no good. What good am I? We've always got to come back to this when the stakes were this high. How high? Well, when he wanted to save you. When your life was on the line in this whole thing, he was willing to give it all up because you're that valuable to him, because he's not willing to just go on without you. That's profound. That's the stuff we use when our enemy comes sneaking around, saying, ah, you're no good. Nobody cares about you. Ah, yeah, whatever. Beat it. Because I know who my God is and I know what he said. That he loved me so much, he was willing to pay this ultimate sacrifice in order to bring me home. We realize in this that because of the unity between the Father and the Son in the mystery of the Trinity, because of their unity, the will of the Lord to crush the incarnate Son also meant that in their unity of their nature, the worst of sin's penalty was ultimately falling on himself. As he said before, I'm going to redeem you, but it's not going to cost you anything. I'm going to see to it that the cost falls completely on me. I'm going to get you back, and it won't cost you a cent. I'll pay it all. So we realize Jesus was no victim. He wasn't a martyr. This was the plan all along. This was how God was going to reconcile the world back to himself, by the servant giving his life, his soul, you know, the life, the soul, we're giving his life up as an offering for guilt. The hero jumps in and takes the bullet for us. But it doesn't end there, because by his act, the righteous servant is going to prolong his days. And that kind of gets a little muddy and stuff. I love how the Message words this whole section. Put the next slide up. Here's how he words it. Still, it's what God had in mind all along, to crush him with pain. The plan was that he give himself as an offering to sin so that he'd see life come from it. Life, life, and more life. And God's plan will deeply prosper through him. Out of that terrible travail of soul, he'll see that it's worth it and be glad he did it. Through what he experienced, my righteous one, my servant, will make many righteous ones as he himself carries the burden of their sins. The death, this offering, this burial of Messiah doesn't end the story because he lives on. He lives to see his offspring, those who are his spiritual descendants, those who are birthed in this new birth because of him. He'll prolong his days. That's an allusion, A-L-L-U-S-I-O-N, allusion to never dying, this state that is beyond death's grasp. And those who are his offspring, obviously, experiencing that with him. Advance the next slide, please, Robbie. Thank you for doing all that, by the way. There's a statement in verse 11 there that is really interesting in the ESV that just jumped out at me. When he says, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. By his knowledge, he'll make many righteous. Now, commentators believe that this knowledge is meaning either our knowledge of him, you know, by a knowledge of him, he'll make many people righteous, or it's talking about the knowledge that he has inherently that he shares, either a knowledge of God or this knowledge of the kingdom of God that he shared in what he expressed. And it may be all of that, but it got me thinking about the beginning of the human story as it unfolds in Genesis, about what started this whole thing, why we needed to be rescued in the first place. Because it all started when mankind fell from a relationship with God, and that happened when a snake offered him fruit from a tree of knowledge, the knowledge of good and evil. There is a knowledge that ruined everything. There's a knowledge that is prevalent today, which seems to flow from that original tree, that doesn't ever seem to rightly reattach us to what it is we know inherently we could be. There's a knowledge that's present that has achieved amazing things, incredible things, things that you never thought would have been believable that we've experienced and known through this knowledge. But that knowledge always falls short. It always comes up just empty of being that satisfying thing that we've craved, that we've known inherently that we need. And it's that knowledge that's prevalent in the world today that makes it hard for us to understand how power can be revealed through submission and sacrifice. But it's this unconventional knowledge that Messiah reveals. It's that knowledge that he brings that makes us right with God, that reveals to us that not everything is as it seems here on the surface. There's something else at work here. There's something deeper to us than we've been led to believe. What Jesus taught, what he revealed in his example, that's the stuff that we want to invest our lives in. It seems to me that's the stuff that's leading towards life, the stuff that reveals wholeness and rightness in our life experience. And all of this leads towards that glorious conclusion of exaltation, the dividing of spoil. And of course, that's archaic expression that is describing the idea of this, you know, of being a winning kind of thing, an idea of total command of the earth, which is, of course, what we're waiting for now. We're waiting for a king, a benevolent king in total command. So this is really, really a good ending, as he's describing, because everything there, he's when it's all said and done, he looks back with immense satisfaction of what it is that was accomplished through all of this travail, as difficult as it was. As Paul says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured this stuff so that he could look back. One day, I believe, it's my belief, we'll all be with him, and he'll be able to look out on all of us. He'll be able to see us all, however he does that, with great satisfaction. We all get to be home together, all together with him where we were meant to be. This weekend, all my kids are going to be back in Panama City. I've said before, that's one of those rare glimpses of heaven that I get nowadays when they're all here And that's what he's looking for. That's what he's anticipating. That's what we're all moving towards. That day, all of us there together. And him looking out, smiling. It was worth it. It was absolutely worth it. Whether he still holds scars or not, I don't know. But he, if he does, he could rub those things, not with the agony of regret, but with the joy of knowing. It was all worth it. They're all home with me. But for us, as we look back at this, from the New Testament perspective, it's so clear. There's so much here, you know. And honestly, I've kept you a while, but you know, we've got a short amount of time to try to dig through a chapter like this. There's so much more. Please don't think that we've covered everything that's in here. There's deep and rich mines of truth in this, but what we see in here, what shines out the brightest as we're looking at this glittering field in front of us, is that God's greatest display of power is revealed through his sacrificial love for us. The greatest display of power that God ever showed us was his willingness to lay down his life in order to rescue us, a love that went to these great lengths to see that we'd be home with him. So let's don't take that for granted. In the life that we live right now, let's not just dismiss that as another religious dogma or doctrine or something. Let's embrace his knowledge and live from that perspective as those ones so valuable that God would go to these great lengths to rescue us. Let's live with that sense of purpose and rightness with God and maybe experience that life we were intended to have. Right on?
Right on.
All right, very cool. Father, thank you so much for your word. We could spend all of eternity just walking around saying just two words, thank you. Thank you for what you did. Thank you for how you enabled us to live through something that surely should have been our death. Thank you for your willingness to bear all of that on our behalf. Thank you that we've got a home in you. Because of this, because of what we read tonight, we know who we are. We know who we belong to and at what price. And we also know where we're going. And armed with that, Lord, we can experience anything. We can go through anything and be whole and be stable in the midst of it. So just reinforce that in our hearts and our minds. Reinforce that in our understanding of how we make choices in this world. And lead us on in this. I pray, Lord, in Jesus' name, amen. Amen. Any comments or questions?